what are the different types of resistances? Some of them are, people just not liking where things are going, right? Like they're like highly skeptical of where things are headed, or maybe they feel threatened and there's sort of some act of sabotage, whether it's conscious or unconscious, towards your project.
Welcome to MRII's Insights and Innovators podcast, where we talk to top market research professionals to get their inside stories about innovative and enduring best practices. Now, here's your host for today's episode.
Welcome to today's episode of Insights and Innovators, Turning Turbulence into Trust. Brianna Silver on Innovation and Insights, and I'm your host and former MRII president, John Last. Brianna is the founder and president of Silver Consulting and the author of the fascinating new book, Leading Through Freefall, How Innovators Turn Turbulence into Trust. In today's conversation, we'll explore how researchers and innovators can navigate uncertainty, reframe resistance, and create safe landings for their ideas in the real world. Brianna, it's great to have you on Insights and Innovators.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thanks for having me, John.
Yeah, this should be a great conversation because, I thinking back on my career, most of us really dread turbulence in projects. But your book actually suggests, as I think we've learned, it's inevitable and even necessary. So let's start with, how should we think differently about those moments when everything feels like freefall?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, your initial thought around it's something that we try to avoid is spot on. And I would say oftentimes we internalize that turbulence, that resistance, that pushback that we get. Many times we can internalize that as a ding to our own competence as leaders to say, what did I not do that I should have done? How could I have done this differently, et cetera. And so my book is saying, we should stop trying to pretend that everything is smooth and that makes a good project. Instead, we should recognize that we are all change makers. And by nature of that, we all go through a grief curve of some sort when it comes to embracing change. And so you should then therefore expect negative emotions to come before the positive, just like a grief curve would be where you first are in denial and then you get into resistance and then you get into bargaining and depression before you finally are like, okay, I can accept that this is where we are and this is where we need to go.
Hopefully that grief curve doesn't take as long as it might in true grief circumstances. But yeah, is that Maslow's hierarchy or am I confusing it?
It's actually a full grief curve. It's Kubler-Ross is the
Kubler-Ross.
Creator
That's right.
Of that. And, actually on that, like, what is the timeline of the grief curve? I think is a really great question. And I think the reality is it's different for each person and it's different for each type of project. So generally speaking, the more transformative the change or the more like counter to maybe like culture narratives, the changes that's being proposed, it's going to take people longer time to go through that grief curve than if it's, a minor change, if you will. Or if, somebody is really invested in that area, let's say you're going to be doing a, a project and you're going to be changing something that somebody owns in the organization. And like, that is what they've been doing for the past 20 years. That's probably going to be a longer grief curve. It's going to take longer to travel that grief curve than, for somebody who's just being asked their opinion on something, but they aren't necessarily invested in what is.
Yeah, no, it seems to embrace one of my themes throughout, which is knowing your audience and knowing it throughout all layers of the organization. It's a pretty powerful way to reframe it. And you also create a framework where you talk about suiting up, freefall, and safe landing, which are three stages of the process. Walk us through those and why they matter for research professionals.
Absolutely. So yeah, the book is structured on three sections. And so the suiting up section is basically all the things that you can predict that you would need to have anchor points. So it's about really consciously setting your project up for success. The area of free fall, these are all the things that come out of left field that you could never predict, yet you have to react. And so you have the choice at that moment. Do you react with grace or do you react with frustration, right, yourself? And do you sort of rebel against that? So the chapters and the tools that are in this side, this section of the book is all around how to navigate resistance with more clarity and resilience. And then the safe landing piece of it is all really around like how to empower your implementation partners and really ensure that what gets created, your insights that get created, your innovations that get created, that they actually have the ability to be implemented and to really come out into the world in the way that you desire of them.
It's an interesting way to frame it. When you talk about suiting up, obviously that's, how you kind of ensure alignment before the turbulence hits. What role can insights professionals play in that stage?
Yeah, so I think you have to think about it. Everybody talks about the word or the phrase actionable insight, right? Everybody's like, I need actionable insight. That's what everybody wants. And a lot of times when people are referring to that in their mind, they're thinking, we need an actionable deliverable. But the reality is that the deliverable, to say that, you're putting way too much intention on the deliverable, too much weight on the deliverable to really have that actionable deliverable. You have to really back up to think about the entire journey that you bring your stakeholders on. And so, like one thing in the suiting up section, for instance, one chapter is all around defining project success. So what does success actually look like and feel like to the stakeholders that you're engaging with? And not just like what ends up on an RFP, because that tends to be kind of like what's in people's head, but the things that actually are really in their heart and is going to make a difference between, the project being perceived as a success long term versus sort of just a quick win for the moment. Another aspect is project scoping. There's a whole tool in that section that's really around like how do you actually scope a project to fully question whether there's blind spots that your stakeholders are bringing into that conversation that could be if you kind of just act based on what they're telling you the problem is and the general direction that they're pointing you in, and you don't sort of question that with a little healthy dose of skepticism, you could end up, traveling down a road that ultimately isn't going to get you to where you want to be. And so that whole suiting up section is just about these things that are kind of like known things that you can do that kind of just like act as mitigation aspects as you start to move through your project.
So let's move into the navigating resistance component, the free fall component, if you will. Certainly one
Yeah.
that I kind of relate to a lot when looking through the book and just thinking about some of the experiences in my career. In fact, you were talking before about the inevitability of disruption within a project. And it's funny because back long before, I want to admit, probably some 25 plus years ago, when gentleman who some of the listeners may know, Ed Sugar and I were working through MRA at the time, Insights Association. We did seminars called Anatomy of a Research Project. And one of the components of it, this was like a live workshop where we brought people together. It was like we gave them a case study, and then about 40 minutes into them working on it collectively, we blew it up. We like created like
I
some
love that.
crazy exogenous factor. But you are, so that's definitely something that I think people need to grapple with. And you kind of take a really, I love a half full, it's more of like a three quarters full perspective that resistance isn't really a roadblock. How do you get researchers to learn to embrace it that way?
Yeah, I love, first of all, that exercise that you had people go through. I think that that's so key. And the resistances, I think first of all, we have to just kind of think about what are the different types of resistances. Some of them are, people just not liking where things are going, right? Like they're like highly skeptical of where things are headed, or maybe they feel threatened, and so there's sort of some act of sabotage, whether it's conscious or unconscious, towards your project, right? And then there's just some that are just like changes of priority, like something new is happening in the organization, and what was important is no longer important, or the timeline you thought you had is not the timeline that you do have, et cetera, right? So I think there's two separate types of resistances that, while they both kind of create a sense of discomfort and anxiety within you as the innovator leading projects, How you deal with them is slightly different. So when it comes to things that are more people-based, like being skeptical or the sabotage, like I think the first thing that we need to be conscious of is not becoming reactive to it. So like not sort of taking the bite, right? Like if somebody's coming at you, the very instinctual thing is like you want to go back at them. And it's kind of like getting to that point where you catch yourself and you kind of like scale out to be like, hold up, something is going on here that is not really about what we're talking about. It's about something else. And so let's pause and really figure out what that something else is. And so throughout the free fall section of the book, there's various tools that are shared to sort of support that pause moment and that reflection moment so that then you can lean into it with a bit more compassion, a bit more grace, not go into the reactive mode associated with it, right? And then from the more like logistical aspects, you still can sort of take on that information, but you want to be like, no, I cannot reduce the timeline of this project by 3 weeks. That is not possible, right? Like you just kind of want to be like really resistant to that and saying, oh, wait, hold up. If they need to reduce the timeline by 3 weeks, do they really need all of the deliverables in 3 weeks?
Exactly.
Or do they just need a portion of it for some meeting that's happening? And so, again, it's like tools for like how to pause and come to that conversation in a more centered and grounded space so that ultimately, as the researcher, you're being able to maintain the integrity of the research that you're doing. And not compromise on the outcomes, but you're being able to meet your stakeholders where they need you to be as well.
Yeah, it's empathy. It's putting yourself in the shoes of that particular stakeholder. I can recall times where like people would say like, "Oh, don't go see him today. He's not the right time." And in a way, that was kind of true.
Right.
But there's more to it than that, at least in how it impacts on you. And you have one of the tools that you mentioned within the section is called slaying energy vampires. I found that interesting. How does that play out in practice?
Yeah, so the slay energy vampires, this is part of the suiting up section, and it's all around like being preemptive to know where the energy drains and sucks in your projects might be. And so it is really sort of taking this Debbie Downer sort of position and bringing your whole team together. It can be, just your internal team, it can be with stakeholders, your broader stakeholder team, whichever feels right for the project. But essentially, suggest you create a spreadsheet. It's got five columns in it. And so column A is really like all the energy drains that you could foresee disrupting the project. And it could be things like, well, what if it's hard to find the people that we're looking for, right? That might be a challenge. It could be, hey, there's 26 different stakeholders as part of this. Like they all can't have a deciding voice. We won't move forward on this, right? Like, so it can be a range of different things. And then the second column is then grading the potential impact of that drain on the project. So just giving it a 1 through 3 rating. And then you come together as a team. So usually we do that as separate, like individual people just kind of populate the spreadsheet. And then we come together as a team to start to then discuss each of those. So we start with the things that are noted as threes and then sort of talk through it and saying, ultimately, with the goal of saying, is that something that we need to take action on now to eliminate or mitigate this risk? Or is it something that we just need to have in our collective consciousness as we move through? The next column is really what is the next step actions that we're going to take? And then, column E is basically for any other contextual insights that would be important. And so we have found that this particular tool does two things. One, it allows us to be preemptive to say, okay, hey, we think these things could become energy drains and sucks on the project. So we're going to take, options A, B, and C now to avoid that. Or the second thing, if it's not something you can act on now, it just creates this active dialogue among the team so that as soon as that thing pops up, should it pop up, we're addressing it versus sort of people pretending it doesn't exist for a little while until it becomes more of a firestorm to deal with.
It's kind of like scenario planning, it sounds like, which is
Yeah,
something
it is.
you initially think about in terms of the mechanics of the project. That's pretty cool. You also, and I think you were kind of touching on it a few moments ago when you talk about emotions and messy humanness. I love, the whole scenario of project scope creep or quick shift and so much of that driven by certain human and personal dynamics. Talk a little bit about how that's kind of really helped lead to breakthroughs in projects.
Yeah, so when we interact with one another, we match people's energy, right? So like if we take just like the project scoping piece of this as an example, like oftentimes, like at least in a research function, we're oftentimes not there right at the genesis of, hey, we need to do this project. Somebody else has thought about this and then they've come to us, whether we're an internal group within an organization or external, like you and I are, right? Like they come to us and say, hey, we've got this project. And so by the time they've come to us with this project, they have simplified this enough for themselves to grab their to kind of to really put their hands around it. And they oftentimes will come with some convicted energy, like, this is the problem, and this is how I want to solve it, and I just need your help to do it, right? And so even the most tenured insights and innovator can be like, okay, yeah, great. Yes, you understand this, you've been living it, I get it. Yes, I can support you in that. Yet I think a lot of times work is ineffective because we kind of get stuck in that, in those blind spots. And so, you know, this is another example where sort of like really cueing in to convicted energy to then say, hold up, let's pause for a second and just get into a dialogue. Like, what is it that you really want to do? And why do you want to do it? And, you know, kind of like a whole project inquiry scoping script that I share that really then starts to unpack what is really going on and really starts to challenge those blind spots. And so an example of where this was incredibly key is we've done work for NASA over the years. And at one point in time, the team had come to us, they had developed a proprietary whiteboard. It was meant to support the International Space Station planners. They had developed it to spec to the engineers, yet it just sat dormant in the corner and nobody used it after it was developed. And so they came to us and said, hey, you know, Brianna, we need to do like a usability type of project where we better understand what features to build into this whiteboard so that people will use it. Yet as they started to share what they were doing, I was like, you know, I don't think the problem is the whiteboard. I think the problem is that you've missed the understanding of what collaboration truly means to these International Space Station planners. And so we ended up shifting the project from being about product usability to being about workflow and process and how that would enable collaboration. And ultimately what came out of it is a roadmap for how to improve seven other systems that they have as part of their workflow to create more integration. Whereas had we just accepted at face value that this was a product usability project, I'm sure we could have come out with new features for that whiteboard, but I'm also quite confident that it would have had no impact on collaboration for the International Space Station planners.
It's a great example. I mean, it's the perfect example of asking questions instead of just taking orders. And so many times researchers can fall into that order taking trap. It's again, as some of the other guests on the series have talked about, deploying a more consultative approach as opposed to just being a doer. I think that's important.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about the safe landing. What are some of the common pitfalls that you see in moving from ideas to real world adoption?
Yeah, I think the biggest common pitfall is that people assume that involvement throughout your project equals commitment to take action on the insights coming from the project. You know, so I think as researchers and innovators, we say, you know, hey, we want stakeholders engaged from the beginning, right? All the way through the process. And I think that that certainly is necessary. However, I think there's another step that a lot of times people miss, which is then saying, okay, based on the insights that we have generated or the innovations that we're suggesting, how does this actually translate into your next steps? How does it slot into your roadmaps, for instance? And so more attention needs to be paid to how to actually support stakeholder teams to really translate those insights into action and for really finding space for those new ideas into existing workflows and roadmaps that they have.
Any other practical advice that you'd have for research leaders who want to make sure that they actually stick and don't just inspire people?
Yeah, so one workshop that we oftentimes will facilitate, there's actually two that I think are really powerful. So the first is what we call go forward workshop. And so this is when you've got like specific innovations, right? Where it's like, okay, we want to take these new directions. And so bringing forward the teams that would be in charge of implementation and really now looking at those new actions compared to a roadmap that they already have. And so the first thing you need to understand is you need to have alignment around what are the key goals. Like if you had to deduce, like what are the 2 to 3 goals of that team and how they're meant to serve the organization right now, what are they? And then you sort of benchmark through this go forward workshop the new ideas compared to what they're currently working on. And it could be that the new ideas still get sort of shelved for a period of time because they are not going to support them in moving forward on those goals at the same level. And it could be also that then they say, gosh, you know, these new ideas are going to turbocharge our ability to achieve those goals. And so, despite the fact that we already have alignment around this roadmap, we need to go to get alignment around a change to that roadmap. So that's one. And then another workshop that we run is what we call a hot rocks workshop. And this is when it's like, you know, there's a clarity on the direction and there's alignment on the direction that people want to go, but there's not necessarily the level of traction towards that direction that people are desiring. And so this is about sort of bringing people together to figure out what are the things that have to be done in the next 90 days? And you really only want to have 3 to 7 actions of the team that need to be done in the next 90 days to achieve that. And so we've seen that level of sort of chunking things down to be really supportive to teams, particularly those teams that kind of get stuck where they like where things are headed, they're fully aligned on it, but the action steps are not necessarily showing that alignment.
So lots of, I'm particularly intrigued by the whole human aspect, by understanding that personal dynamic of the environment within your working. And you kind of describe yourself as leading with kindness. How does that leadership style shape innovative outcomes?
Yeah, it's all around compassion. So, you know, one of the funny things about this book that as readers read it, I make the analogy of like a Care Bear. And you know, like a Care Bear of love, I think is what I call it. And it's silly and it's kind of stupid, but at the same time, like it's such a good image and a good talisman for me because when I get into those moments where, you know, it's like those pause moments, like okay, something bigger is happening here than what, you know, I'm re receiving or dealing with it right in front of me. By bringing that image into my mind, it allows me to show up with a lot more compassion, a lot more like centeredness and groundedness, a lot more care to just really say what actually is happening here, and then how can we meet each other halfway in this process.
Yeah, I often tell my teams, act like you own the company. And I don't necessarily mean it being our company, but the client's company from a product
Yeah.
standpoint. We could talk for hours. I do want to ask you one more thing before we wrap up today, and that's kind of taking that crystal ball future look. When we think about the coming years and all the disruption and change in marketing and research and organizational dynamics, what turbulence do you think researchers should be preparing for in the next chapter of innovation?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, as you said, you know, the global economy is changing dramatically, you know, from supply chains to international relations to just major disruptions in work processes and talent pools, et cetera, because of AI. And so, you know, given the pace and the scale of all of that change, I think it's critical for organizations to really intentionally manage the emotional energy of their workforce through that change. You know, you have already like this trending phrase of emotional intelligence. And this is important whether things are going well or they're going bad. You know, I mean, I think people will try to, they'll put more attention to that if it's going bad because like something's got to give, right? But it's important just as much as if things are going well because that's going to be the secret sauce to turbo boost those good time moments. So the key takeaway is that, you know, a higher level of emotional intelligence is needed to navigate all of this unprecedented change that we're experiencing. And, you know, the beautiful thing about leading through free fall is that it really offers some concrete tactics for how leaders can really lean into that call to lead the emotional energy of themselves, their teams, and their stakeholders.
Such a fascinating but critical aspect of what we all do on a day-to-day basis, and what I think will be one of those immutable truths that stays consistent despite all of the change happening around us. Brianna, thanks so much for joining us on Insights and Innovators. We've learned so much. And again, I wish we could go longer on this. Just so much great stuff. I hope listeners will be intrigued enough to pick up a copy of the book. Thank you all for tuning in, and we will see you on a future episode of Insights and Innovators. And we're
thanks
out.
So much for taking. Okay.
Go ahead, say it and we'll edit it back in.
Do you mind if I share the download in that process?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah, I don't mind at all. I don't mind at all.
Okay.
So,
John, I so appreciate you having me here. And I also want to offer just a free gift to all of your listeners, a free gift of a chapter of the book. So they can access that by leadingthroughfreefall.com/insights and innovators using the ampersand for the and, just as in your podcast. And specifically, the chapter that I'm going to give is all around that project scoping script that I gave a little bit of a hint to earlier on in the conversation.
Excellent. I really appreciate the generosity there. And again, thanks for being with us.
So appreciate it.
Thanks for joining the Insights and Innovators podcast from Market Research Institute International. Click subscribe to never miss an episode and visit us at mrii.org for more market research insights.